From the inside out, creating wellness and preventing illness. Because if you have your health, you truly are wealthy beyond measure. Here's a doctor who is always on call, Dr. Mehmet Oz.
On Oprah Radio.
Dr. Oz, Oprah Radio, welcome to a very important show today. I've been talking a lot on the show this season about integrative approaches to medicine. And some of these are, you know, herbs and vitamins and this and that. But there's a whole field of medicine, which is outside the conventional realm, which offers folks hope for solutions in otherwise terminal conditions. One of the most classic examples of this is represented by my guest today, Stanislav Brzezinski. And Dr. Brzezinski is a man who, for several decades, has represented what an alternative approach, scientifically based, but an alternative approach to treatment of cancer could be. In part because of that, he's gotten into some trouble, which we're going to talk about. Been challenged by folks from organized medicine and supported broadly by a lot of patients who he's taken care of. This is a story that has been covered by Oprah. It's been in the news a lot. He's an internationally recognized physician, and the battles that he's had with the FDA and the like are legendary. But I first actually got a deeper insight into the story by looking at a movie that my mother-in-law, who, as you all know, will not come on the show, but continually pesters me with information, showed me over a recent vacation. And it was a wonderful movie. I say wonderful because it's well done. You may not agree with the conclusions, or you may not like what you're about to hear today, but the movie is compelling. It's a beautiful summary of the battle, told grippingly by Eric Merola, who's joining us today as well. And I thought if you put the two of these folks together, we could come up with a story that would at least would offer you different vantage points. And the tale that we'll weave today will be one that you will certainly remember. So thank you both for joining me.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
So let me give you about 2 seconds of background. Dr. Brzezinski is a physician, MD, but also a PhD. He's been doing cancer research for 40 years plus, probably. And is recognized as a pioneer in this area, even though his big discovery of anti-neoplastins, remember, neoplasm is a cancer, but anti-neoplastins is a approach that targets cancer cells very specifically without destroying normal cells. It's the holy grail, if it works. And I say that on purpose because I want Dr. Brzezinski to defend it. But it is he attested that is the case. Many patients that he's taken care of who are still alive, who should not be, have told congressional committees that's the case, and these are covered nicely in the movie. Eric Merola began his career working as a freelance art director on Madison Avenue, and meanders his way from there into making this movie. I'm going to ask him a bit about how he moved from working with commercial clients like Old Navy, Nickelodeon, into making movies, because you do the latter well. So Dr. Brzezinski, first let me start with you, if you don't mind. Take me back to the discovery of antineoplastins. What gave you the idea so long ago that you could actually target very specifically cancer cells, something that people have been trying to do since then have not been able to do it as well as we would have hoped?
Well, as usual in science, it happens through a certain coincidence. I was working on my PhD thesis in biochemistry, and I was working on peptides and amino acids, which are part of bigger team of proteins. I was studying the levels of amino acids and peptides in blood in healthy individuals and also in patients who have different conditions. The idea was to correlate the changes in amino acids and peptides in blood with patients' condition to perhaps use this for diagnosing the other illnesses. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily cancer, it was just screening. But I stumbled upon a group of newly discovered peptides. I discovered a new group of peptides in blood.
And peptides, for everybody, are proteins.
Peptides are small proteins. They are chains of amino acids. And I discovered a number of them in blood. These peptides were never described before. But I didn't have any idea what they do. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I realized that patients who have advanced cancer, they don't have enough of such chemicals in their system. And the first idea was perhaps there is some correlation between cancer and lack of such chemicals in blood. Perhaps these chemicals can do something for patients with cancer if we isolate them and give it back to the patients. So this was first a logical idea. I characterized these molecules. I went through my thesis. Then I would like to further purify them, determine structure, and see what they do. Mm-hmm. But it was impossible to do it in the condition where I lived in the communist Poland. There were no resources for such research, and I was not privileged because I was against the communism. So the only way for me to make a progress is to come to the United States, and that's what I did. In 1970, on the Labor Day, I came to the United States, and I landed in Bronx, which is the greatest place to be for the immigrant. It really hardened you enough to appreciate America.
Believe me, there have been movies made about immigrants in the Bronx.
That's
so,
right.
So let me just fast forward for 1 second. How did you first begin to use antineoplastins in patients? Tell me about the first case where you thought, my goodness, there's something going on here. I've got to yell to the mountaintops about this.
Well, it took a long year. It took about 7 years from the time I arrived to America. I was lucky enough to have faculty position at Baylor College of Medicine. At that time, Baylor was a hub of scientific activity. Especially, they had a lot of activity in the research on peptides. They just were given Nobel Prize to a couple of researchers at Baylor who were working on peptides released from hypothalamus for Dr. Gilman and Dr. Schally. Dr. Schally, as a matter of fact, he was American of Polish origin. Mm. So I was lucky enough to inherit the equipment from these guys. They left Baylor College, but I got their labs and inherited their equipment. And my boss at that time at Baylor, who hired me specifically because my expertise on peptides, he gave me a free hand to pursue my research project on peptides which are isolated from blood. Of course, it was impossible to do it on my own at Baylor. So then I developed a relationship with the team from MD Anderson Cancer Center, some of the greatest mind in cancer research at the time. And I was humbled. At that time, I was 27 years old, a young guy, and suddenly NCI gave me the grant, and I was named principal investigator to study peptides, which I discovered. And the guys who I was supposed to supervise were people who were famous. They could be my fathers, and they have great accomplishment in the field of cancer. These were the people from MD Anderson, but they were great people. They would like to work with me, and together we proceed further in the research. So these were the people from MD Anderson who found that what I discovered in blood has activity against cancer, and what is even more, whichever peptide fraction they tried, they found some pronounced activity against cancer cells in laboratory systems. At the same time, they found that these chemicals did not inhibit, they did not kill normal cells. This was something truly remarkable at that time. It was no big deal to find some molecules which can kill cancers in test tube in petri dishes. But it was something very remarkable to find such chemicals which could not kill normal cells. And that's what we did. So then we embarked on years of study to characterize these molecules, to find out what they are, to determine their chemical structure, and finally bring them to the level when we can do animal testing. This took us a long time. Finally, in 1976, I presented our data at one of the largest medical conventions in the United States. It was at that time at Anaheim, it was Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology and Medicine, and there was overwhelming enthusiasm about it.
But just to be clear, this big facet being that you're at,
yes.
Were you presenting data on patients, or was it...
No. This was experimental data.
So what was the first patient that you actually treated where you saw a benefit where maybe other physicians would not have expected any change?
Well, so finally, after years of experimentation, we are ready to embark on clinical trials. And my first approach was to ask Baylor College, where I worked, please give me the permission to do clinical trials. And you normally go through institutional review board. That's a normal system. Then they gave me round and round. They told me, okay, we give you such permission, but first you need to have a permission from the FDA. And the FDA told me, no, first you have to get permission from IRB, Institutional Review Board. So there was no way
to... What year ultimately did you treat your first patient?
Well, so ultimately what happened is following. I was prepared to treat patients. I couldn't do it in the United States. Just around the Christmas of 1976, I was approached by desperate people from Mexico. This was a son of the prominent Mexican lawyer who was dying from cancer. They were begging me, look, please come to Mexico, and together with a prominent doctor in Mexico who later became the boss of American National Cancer Institute, let's give this patient a try. Let's see if you can save the grass. Well, as a matter of fact, the name of this patient was Jesus, which is remarkable.
Ironic, right.
Just around Christmas time. So I decided to go to Mexico. I brought the medicine. And the doctor, who later became the director of Mexican National Cancer Institute, administered the medicine to this patient. This was the first historical case.
And how did he do?
Well, he responded for a while, then he died, unfortunately. So it was not successful. But historically, it was the first case. I was not the one who administered the medicine. The Mexican oncologist did it. So, but again, historically, this was the first case.
So just to put a timeline for everybody. So this is 1976. It went out 35 years later.
Yes.
And there's a drug that is argued by some to be life-saving, life-changing. And the real question that the documentary that my mother-in-law forced me to watch was, why has this not gotten a broader assessment? Or has it been demonstrated not to be effective? We just don't know about it. So let me talk to Eric Merola for a second. Now, you had a promising career, lots of things going on. What would captivate your imagination to dedicate the time required to craft a movie like this?
And, you know, as you said, I've been working here in New York for a long time in various forms of media. But frankly, doing documentary films and working in films where I've always wanted to be, where I've always sort of aspired to. And working on other documentary films as well, I've always wanted to do my own. And I frankly just stumbled upon his story. And it's one of those things, we've all been there, where it just sticks with you. And it just never went away. And after being sort of personally obsessed with it, I started emailing the clinic and calling the clinic.
Before you jump past that, you're in advertising, and how do you get, people don't just go pleasure reading about cancer cure doctors in other parts of the world. How'd you read about it the first time?
Frankly, the first time? Yeah. There's a great book published in the 80s called The Cancer Industry by a man named Ralph Moss, who worked at Sloan Kettering. If you remember, well, I won't go into all the details, but essentially he worked for Sloan Kettering as a PR guy. He was their PR guy. And there was some sort of shenanigans going on there, and he blew the whistle on, and he was fired, and he was pissed off. Excuse me. He was upset. And he wrote a book about
satellite
it.
Satellite radio, because he pissed off.
Okay, sorry. Okay,
pissed
sorry.
Off.
He pissed off. And he was so pissed off that he also dedicated a chapter to Brzezinski. He sort of talked about these other treatments that were marginalized. And of all the other so-called alternative treatments out there, while lifestyle change is important, diet's very important, what he discovered was a genuine scientific chemical discovery versus all the other ones. And that really stood out to me. Then you couple that with he's got patents on it, he's in clinical trials, not to mention the legal battles. I just couldn't stop thinking about it. That's all I can tell you. I didn't just one day decide to do it. I just started personally researching it, emailing and calling him. Finally, after 6 months of bugging him, he let me into his world. And I thought I was going to do something about the patients, you know, just do a little short thing. I wasn't really sure. It's just one of those things I just couldn't put down. And then when I learned how deep the legal battles were, and then all the other things that went around it, that's when I got to a point and I talked to my wife and I went, I really am excited about this. I want to make this film. This is going to
be still married, I gather.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Somehow, yeah.
Sometimes these movies are story related.
One of the things I thought was the best part about your movie was that we watch a lot of these documentaries. Often they're very dry and factual and boring to watch. Yours is actually downright funny, the irony, because you uncover the irony in the situation where there seems to be a lack of interest or outright antagonism for something that could possibly work. And the way you portray that is so entertaining.
Thank you so much. What's so great about this film, too, for me, it wrote itself. The story was just sitting there. And what also made me excited was no one had ever made a freaking documentary about this story. It's incredible.
But didn't that scare you a little as well? I mean, I've had the opportunity. I heard about Dr. Brzezinski's work. I probably was a resident. I mean, it was a long time ago. And what you usually hear is there's this, you know, eccentric fellow down in Texas or Arizona. We don't even know where he is, but he's in Texas. But, you know, you're not sure because I'm in New York and I'm hearing this from New York guys. But, you know, this stuff doesn't really work. If it really worked, we'd know about it. Isn't that what you, everyone out there is listening to this show right now. I mean, I'm hoping that's what you're thinking because that's what I was thinking. I don't want to be the only one. So you're coming from the outside. I suspect that most of the traditional conventional physicians you spoke to, if you did speak to any, would have said, well, I don't really know much about him, but I know that it's not real. Because, again, if it was real, we'd know about it.
That's exactly right. And that's obviously part of my reason why I was so excited about making the case that I did, again, because all of it was just sitting there for a storyteller like myself to tell it. I've spoken to a lot of people about it, and it makes common sense. Most people would react that way. I've talked to various people in the cancer field, some of the most cutting edge guys, supposedly on the gene targeted research side. And they've flat out told me that if this was real, someone would have jumped on this by now. Some pharmaceutical company would have picked this up by now. It's very, I don't know what to tell you. It's very fascinating. Between the paradigm shift part of it and perhaps the business side of it, it's a fascinating scenario. His attorney, when I interviewed him, he said, frankly, if this medicine did not have his name on it, if it was owned by someone else, like a Pfizer or an Amgen, it would be out a long time ago, especially when you consider the track record he's had with pediatric brain tumors. Because his case is an individual scientist with his own incorporated small company, to do what he's doing outside of the pharmaceutical world, is that alone, it's just no one's ever done it. And the business world doesn't know what to do with it. If you know what I mean,
But let me challenge you now a little bit. I just want to understand this, because this is, to me, the crux of the entire issue. If you're out there listening and you have a loved one with cancer and you've been told that there's not much that can be done for them, or the therapies that are being offered are so toxic and you know about those toxicities that you don't want to go that road if you don't have to, and those are the people who are coming, flocking to Stanislav Brzezinski's clinic to be seen by him. And I would gather that most of them, asking the exact same question I'm still asking myself, is why would anyone try to sabotage that? And I just want to dive into that a little bit, because if you're in my wife's camp, and I want Lisa to speak to this as well, you're ready to believe that someone would sabotage it because it wasn't in their best interest. But maybe I'm naive about this, but I would think that someone would have invaded his territory, would have bought his company. I mean, come on, if I offered you the cure to cancer and I was a one man shop down in Texas, and I don't care what it costs, people pay hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars to buy companies. This is the cure to cancer. This would be a foundation of every chemotherapeutic regime going forward. It would be a revolutionary, groundbreaking at every level. You become the dominant company. Well, how much is too much to pay for that?
I agree. In the film, too, if you remember, I cover a little bit of it. And there was interest from some Italian pharmaceutical companies, Japanese, and an Irish company. And the only one that moved, the Italian and the Japanese didn't move forward because they knew the FDA was giving them such a hard time. So why wouldn't we invest all this money if we can never get it approved anyway by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States? That's sort of like the hub of the planet for the most part. And then the only other one, the Irish company, they partnered with the NCI. One of his former scientists ran off and tried to make duplicate patents. So
I'm going to take a quick break, because I want to come back and dive into that, why that happened. But also the big question you should be asking yourself, everybody, is why would the FDA not want a life-saving therapy to be approved? Dr. Oz with Lisa, we'll be right back.
This is Oprah Radio.
Here's one of the best-known heart surgeons in the world, and he's with you every day. It's Dr. Mehmet Oz on Oprah Radio.
And we're back. Dr. Oz here in New York City with Lisa. We got two great guests visiting with us. If any of you have ever had a loved one or yourselves had cancer, some of the therapies that are offered are toxic, destructive. The hope is you'll kill the cancer cells before you kill yourself. Sometimes it doesn't happen, unfortunately. Stanislav Brzezinski is a groundbreaking, internationally recognized physician, not for always good reasons, who's developed a therapy called anti-neoplastins. He's been talking about this for 40 years, and I'm investigating with both Dr. Brzezinski and Eric Marola, a very bright young filmmaker who's made a documentary about Dr. Brzezinski's crusade, about why that is so. And this is bigger than just a cure for cancer, although that seems big enough on its own. But why is it that, in theory, well-meaning organizations like the FDA, like companies that could buy products and market them and make money off them, why wouldn't these companies, entities, be supportive of this endeavor? What's holding us back? So, Eric, you're telling a story very quickly. You have three companies who are interested in buying this. Two of them drop out because of the FDA. I'll come back to the FDA issue in a second. One company says, maybe, and then the patent, and you talk about this, the movie gets stolen. Why would the FDA, an organization that represents us and regulates therapies to keep us safe, why would they not want a cure for cancer on the market?
Yeah, no, it's a big one. On the sidebar, if you look at other parts of the industry, with the oil market, and you see the electric car around 2003 was basically killed. If you remember that, and it's the cancer industry or medicine is not immune to the same sort of activity. when it comes to self-preservation of an entity, of an enterprise that huge, of a cartel in a way, that huge, they will do whatever it takes to preserve that. You know, these guys behind these desks want to preserve stock prices. They want to keep things preserved. And when something new comes in, regardless of social, of its wonderful social benefit, we see it all the time. So that's one side of it. I'm going back what we talked about earlier.
But there's a fundamental difference there, because an oil company makes money from oil. So an electric car actually is taking away their business. A pharmaceutical company makes therapies for cancer. But if you have a better cancer treatment, you keep more people alive to be able to treat them even more with your cancer drug. So I would think that somebody, and it's competitive, somebody out there would say, I'll pay Brzezinski or whatever it's going to be, a ton of money, but I'll buy this cure. Now, all my drugs will be partnered with put on top of his chassis for cures. And I'd be the biggest pharmaceutical company out there.
Wouldn't you be afraid they'd bury it? If I were Brzezinski, I'd be afraid they'd buy it and then bury it.
Why would they bury it? Why would you bury a cure? Why not just make money off the cure?
You talked about the FDA, but you know, we think about the FDA. The FDA is supposed to be an independent entity. And you know, in 1992, a pharmaceutical company came in and lobbied Congress to create what's called the User Fee Drug Act, I believe it's called. And what that did was it funneled money from the pharmaceutical industry into the FDA and bloated it. It's huge. All these new staff, and under the guise of we need more staff, we need to rush more drugs through for the benefit of the public. But that may be true. But what it also did is it basically bought and paid for the Food and Drug Administration in many respects. Dr. Marcia Angel, former editor-in-chief of New England Journal of Medicine, has been screaming from the rooftops about this for years. And so you have an entity now that is basically in bed, I hate to say, with the industry. And the very entity that's supposed to monitor this industry and keep it in check for people like you and me is now working together, and it's a very dangerous sort of scenario. So that was in the early 90s. So when you combine that, knowing that entity is in existence, and as he got into all these things, that all the legal troubles that were unsubstantiated, it just sort of, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to say. I don't like to jump to conclusions and point fingers, but I sort of have to do the math. Why would the FDA, oh my goodness, why would they go to 5 grand juries, and why would they indict him? And like, what's more interesting, in March of 1996, the Clinton administration had this new legislation they were trying to put forth to rush new cancer drugs through. Kessler stood up in a press conference talking about this, and people in the press were saying, does this mean this new legislation to push new cancer drugs through, does that include antineoplastons? And that was the same year he was indicted by the FDA's, David Kessler's FDA. So it's very fascinating. With the film, I just tried to show the facts and try not to...
Well, I've had David Kessler on my TV show, and I have a lot of respect for his willingness to speak up. He's right now, as you probably know, being criticized by a lot of people in the food industry, because he's taken on sugar and salt as addictive substances that are purposely being used by different food manufacturers to get us to eat their products and thus make us fatter, more hypertensive, etc. So he's outspoken. I have always found defender of what he thinks is right. Now, the bigger question that comes up in my mind is, do we, because we're all human, do we develop biases about things where we think Stanislav Brzezinski is this charlatan working out of a small little makeshift clinic, charging people a lot of money to treat them with cancer drugs, and by doing that, profiting by taking advantage of people at their weakest, which is, I suspect, what people at the FDA are thinking, because I have asked so many clinicians, and that's the first response. But then what's been, and the reason we're doing the show today is when I asked the second question, which is, what do you really know about this stuff? There's really not much behind it. There's not much insight into what you're doing down there. There's not much deep thought about clinical work that's been done by you, not much understanding about what these products could be. So it bothers me a little bit when I see a story which has been circling around, and people, it's like political battles. You already know the answer. You're already for or against abortion. No one's going to change your mind on it. And now you all of a sudden find new breaking knowledge that, you know, in fact, you've got this, you know, this tool out there that you've been willing to ignore for your entire career. Now, how do you deal with that reality? So, Dr. Brzezinski, maybe if I can turn back to you. So this young filmmaker calls you up. I suspect there was an understandable amount of trepidation to, you know, sort of revisit things that have been so painful for you for much of your life. If you had to look forward... you've seen the movie, obviously. You were in it, starring part. You had a lot of supporters in the movie. The movie, by the way, opens with a gripping scene from an FDA panel discussion, I gather, with a young police officer telling the story about how his infant daughter developed cancer, and you know, it's incurable cancer, unfortunately, and And I don't remember the details of it, but it was several years earlier.
When she did pass away because she'd gotten a lot of radiation, but when she died, she had no cancer. So it was actually the radiation that had dissolved her brain, was I think what her father said, but the cancer had been cured.
And the man most compelling to me said, I spent my life defending the public. Why wasn't the public defending me? And that's the big question that I'm trying to ask today. So is you look at your career and the movie that summarizes it, what do you see as the opportunity in the future? For the many people out there who are listening who may have loved ones who have cancer, what are the options for them?
Well, now we are facing the times in medicine, which occurred perhaps once in the century. And this is a paradigm shift. Well, changing from the old approach to a new approach. Now, there's a realization that cancer is not just a single disease or perhaps even 200 different types of diseases. This is perhaps 500,000 different illnesses. Mm-hmm. Each individual patient has different cancerous genome, which is causing cancer. And that's what needs to be treated. So you need to treat patient as the individual, not group the patients who have, for instance, lung cancer and run clinical trials. No, change the approach. Fine. Let's design the clinical trials the way that you have a group of patients with incurable disease and find out what's the best what I can do for these patients by using medications which are available. Not really what is the best what I can do for a particular medicine by treating the group of patients the same way with single medicine. No. Find what kind of combination of medications I can use which will work on the genes which are causing cancer in individual patient. It's a completely different approach.
So let me just clarify this for everybody, yes. So we're all on the same page. I was explained this by Dr. Brzezinski in a conversation, so I have some insight into it. So if I understand correctly, what you're saying is someone out there has surgery. They have to save the tissue from the cancer that's been removed, which you should all do anyway, by the way, everybody out there. You know, there are much more sophisticated ways of analyzing cancer cells now, and you want to understand what the actual genes are in each cancer. So let's talk about glioblastomas for a second, yes. Which is a brain tumor, a generally lethal brain tumor. And you taught me that there are probably 500 different genes that are expressed, 500 different proteins can be made. Around these tumors. And they're not all the same. So not every glioblastoma, not every lung cancer, not every breast cancer, not every prostate cancer is the same. They all vary depending on who you are and how it grew in you. So you send it off to a laboratory in Arizona. You identify what the fingerprint is of that cancer. Then if I understand correctly, you'd say that, okay, a couple of these chemotherapeutic agents, if they're teamed up correctly, it's like a recipe for a pie. You take drug A, that works for specific spicy problems in this cancer. Drug B works for the sweet problems in the cancer. And then antineoplastins offers a different pathway. And by combining them in the right ways, now you can customize therapy rather than blasting away with the same Agent Orange for every single cancer cell.
Absolutely. Instead of treating the type of cancer diagnosed under optic microscope, which is a very old idea, introduced 160 years ago, mm-hmm. we have to identify cancerous genome. And that's different for every patient. And now we have capabilities of doing this. It can be done within 2 weeks. That's a standard period of time. Insurance covers this. Then we identify medications which can treat the genes which are causing cancer in this particular patient.
So why? Is that not standard of care in America today?
It should be, but it's a great difficulty because of old entrenched approach. Because the old approach is, let's use single medicine in clinical trials, identify the group of patients which have the same diagnosis under optic microscope, not by looking to genome, and then use eventually combination of 2, then combination of 3, combination of 5, combination of 6 if necessary. It will take years and years. According to the director of the National Cancer Institute of National Institute of Health, NIH, during the Bush administration, Dr. Bernardine Healy, it will take 30 years before this practice will be available for American doctors because of the way the doctors and the planners think. This needs to be completely changed. This technology is available today. The lives can be saved today. Why antineoplastins can be of great help? Because antineoplastins cover the spectrum of 100 genes which are involved in cancer. We know what are these genes. We can map exactly the treatment plan by affecting the genes which are causing cancer in this particular individual. Of course, we may fail because we may not cover all of these crucial genes which are necessary. It doesn't mean that we need to cover 500 different genes. No. These genes work in the pathways. They are grouped together. it could be that in our practice, it looks like we can work out on about 100 to 200 different genes, and we are fine. But why we should combine antineoplastins with the other medications? Because these other medications may cover the genes which are not covered by antineoplastins. We can add, for instance, Nexavar or sorafenib, which covers 14 different genes. We can add, for instance, sunitinib or sutent, which covers 9 genes. Right. And if we put this together, the combination of perhaps 4 or 5 different medications will cover a sufficient number of genes which can work for this patient and save life. And we can do it today. There are about 1,200 medications approved by the FDA. I'm talking about medications which cover broad spectrum, cancer, various diseases. It was found that some of these medications which work on different diseases also have the activity against genes which work on cancer. For instance, Celebrex. Right. It can work on the genes which are important in cancer also. It can be identified by running genome analysis which of these medications can be useful. The same applies to ingredients of diet. The same applies to vitamins. By having the information on 24,000 genes, which constitute the menu of the genome, you can identify what is good out there, which I can use to help this patient. But you need to possess the knowledge. You need to know that, all right, this medication which I would like to use already passed phase 2 or phase 3 clinical trials. And I can use it because I know that this medication used a single drug will offer such and such chance for this patient. Then I can combine this with another medication because there were already clinical trials on the combination and it looks like it's safe to combine this. So it requires constant surveillance, constant search of medical literature to find out what clinical trials were conducted out there to make sure that our choice is right. So it's a very, very complex process. Software which will make it available for regular oncologists so he does not need to learn this whole thing like learning Mandarin Chinese. He'll have a software available hopefully by the end of the year which will tell him, okay, for this particular cancer genome, here is the best combination of medications. And this will be ultimately his judgment to make sure if this is the right decision or wrong decision.
Talking to Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski, the well-known physician, and Eric McCulloch-Merlo, who's made a wonderful movie chronicling some of the battles that he's had with the FDA. The website movie is BrzezinskiMovie.com.
That's correct.
Which is worth looking at. The trailer there itself will captivate you and gives you a lot of bit.
Well, I just wanted some numbers. So typically with a glioblastoma, for example, what's the survival rate 5 years?
5 years for glioblastoma is practically zero. However, and there is very small percentage of patients. I'm talking about standard approach.
Right, but with you, so zero standard.
Zero standard.
But with your treatment, what?
With our treatment, we are around 15%, which is low. Glioblastoma, in our treatment, when we use antineoplastin alone, is giving us relatively low survival rate. But we have some other brain tumors which are giving us great survival rate, which is 70% survival rate after 5 years. Glioblastoma is not the best type of brain tumors for our treatment because glioblastoma has very, very complex genome, over 500 different genes.
But it's still a lot bigger, 15 is still a lot bigger than zero.
It's still not bad, but for instance, if you look at brainstem glioma, which also includes glioblastoma, is an even deadlier tumor than glioblastoma because there are no survivors at 5 years, if you are talking about children. Then at 5 years, we have something like 30% survivors by using antineoplastins. And we have now patients who are surviving over 20 years completely free from tumor, first time in medical history. So that's probably the toughest type of malignancy which we successfully treated. But in the other types of brain tumors, astrocytoma in children, for instance, which is the most common brain tumor, well, our survival at 5 years is over 70%. So it varies on each of these malignancies because they have different genome. And even within the group, what is, say, glioblastoma, every patient is different. And we need to really look into genome to find out who has a better chance.
Eric, last word to you. What do you hope people take away from the movie?
I hope people realize that this is not just, yes, the legal battles are intense. Yes, what happened to him makes for a great story. And it makes it great. It's a classic David and Goliath story. What people need to realize is that we're witnessing a paradigm shift of cancer treatment. This is a gene-targeted therapy. It's based on a real discovery. It's now in clinical trials. It's not some fringe thing that you have to go to Tijuana to get. Our FDA is cooperating with him. He's been given permission for phase 3, final phase of testing. It is going to be approved for market unless some crazy thing out of nowhere happens. This is going to be on the market. I guess this is the best I can tell you, is that the people should have hope. Yes, it's a terrible story what happened, but he's still here today. He's still cooperating with the FDA. It's going to be approved. I just want people to know that there's hope. And I'm so excited about the first film that I'm doing a second one focusing. I think I may have mentioned to you in an email, but a second one focusing on the personalized side that he's talking about, with mapping the entire human genome, the combination therapies. Because he learned that because he realized that antineoplastons is a gene-targeted drug. And he applied that while that's busy in the bureaucratic red tape of clinical trials. He's just moving forward anyway. And he has a form of antineoplastons approved that he's using in addition to that. So I just hope people see it and realize there is hope. And I'm just going to say one note about glioblastoma. You know, after I finished the film, my cousin, glioblastoma, as he said, very, very difficult to treat. And if anyone has studied it, it's a very aggressive. It doubles in size every 30 days. It's very aggressive. My cousin, her first MRI after a month of treatment, it's breaking down. Mm. So she's one of the lucky ones of maybe the 15%. So far, she may not survive it sadly. But So far, so good. It's very exciting. After two surgeries and chemo and radiation failed her, at least this option is there. And that's another thing I want people to realize. There's another option there. If you don't believe it, fine. If you want to take standard route, please, you know, that's your right. But know that there's something else there.
Well, I applaud you for differentiating confusion from mystery, because there's an elegance to looking at events as mysterious as cancer and being able to understand. Dr. Brzezinski, thank you for all your many contributions, for your desire to keep fighting forward. I really don't know, and I have to speak as a physician for, and for everybody out there, enough about what's really happening in cancer therapy to tell people to flock down to see you. But I do think, and I talk about second opinions all the time, it is worth taking a look at Dr. Brzezinski's work before you decide on the chemotherapy you're going to agree on. And push the doctors in your life to at least understand what this whole antineoplastin and targeted gene therapy movement is all about. It'll probably, at the end of the day, make all of us a lot smarter. Again, thanks for pushing no matter what.
Thank you very much.
Lots more to come. Stay with us. This is Dr. Oz, Oprah Radio.